I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Reid.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast. Hey, Ben. Last episode, you and I were discussing how we started out with the same goal, that is to be in the games industry, and I spent a decade or so doing so, whereas you, through no fault of your own, ended up not working in games. And then,
yes,
sort of like 20-odd years into our careers, we've met up, and we've been discussing kind of the things that went well, the things that didn't go so well, the things that differ. And last time, we specifically were talking about testing and how I hadn't really learned how to do testing as a first category of thing. It was like something that I learned much later in my career, whereas you've kind of made a thing about testing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was sort of all of the XP practices. Because like, as you said, you know, I didn't get to fulfill my dream of becoming a game developer, you know, falling like Icarus covered in feathers and wax from the sky into the reality of the cold, harsh world. But what I did do is I got really into sort of like extreme programming and extreme programming engineering practices, because that's really what that whole thing was about.
When you say extreme programming, I hear people like bandy it around. But what do you mean when you say extreme programming?
So does
it have the capital letters?
Yeah, XP. I don't know why they capitalized the, but you know, maybe EP.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, it sounds cooler that way. But so XP was this process. I mean, some people still use it, but it's like this process for building software that, you know, was invented or developed kind of like as part of this various projects in sort of the late 90s and early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And it was an engineering focused approach to building software, as opposed to a lot of the other approaches at that time, which were much more sort of, I don't know, business oriented, I guess, is the way that you describe
it.
Not programming.
Waterfall type stuff, or not even that.
I mean, I'm not really talking about that. Like the contrast that I have in my career was the thing that I first started doing when I graduated from school was working for this company in Houston doing data visualization, and they used a process there called RUP, the Rational Unify process. And I tried that for
rational,
like
as in rational rows.
Yes, as in rational rows.
The actual,
right? Like,
yeah, Grady
Booch. IBM. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I tried that for a year and I was like, this is gross, and found XP and got way into it from there. So yeah, so my career, instead of going into the games industry, I got way into agile engineering practices like test-driven development, pair programming, continuous integration, and all that stuff. And I've been doing that basically since, you know, for almost 20 years now.
Which is very, very different from the grind-oriented programming that I experienced in North London, living a mile away from where my office was, making it home after closing time from the pub, staggering into bed, getting back up again, going into work and work long hours and grinding and essentially applying human effort of will as opposed to actual sound design practices to making software work, which, you know, we, towards the end, in fairness, I paint this picture, towards the end, in fairness, we were starting to pick up on some practices. We did have some tests, but I think, like I said last time, most of them were assert based. And being in the games industry, we were working mainly in C and C++, you know, in some assembly and some other weird things that we used. But the mainstay of that was developing for consoles that were not standard. They weren't something you could just run and deploy to. There were steps involved in actually getting it to run. You know, in some cases there was a serial cable and you had to like squirt your software down into it to make it work. They had different architectures from the host machine that you were running on, so you couldn't just build and run them locally. And so testing was very much something that we did on a subset of important code that we bothered to get ported to run on x86, or if we were working on a PC game, then obviously we could do some amount of it, but it was basically assert-based testing. But even then, even accounting for all those things, right now, fast forward 20-odd years, and we're talking about server software for the finance industry, and we have all the capabilities open to us, and yet testing is still hard in C and C++. And so I thought one thing we could talk about this time specifically is, why is that the case, and what can we do?
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic idea.
So you have described to me as like, good design can often yield testability, or perhaps the other way around, right? If you design for testability, that is a good design. So yeah. Maybe there's something wrong with our design. So let's start from like what makes something easy to test, what makes something testable, and then we can sort of I'll try and riff on why that maybe doesn't work for me or maybe it does.
Right.
Maybe so it yeah.
I mean, I think for me, and I mean this is my own personal belief, but code isn't well designed unless it's testable. That's just a criteria of design that it's like,
right.
And it's a much more concrete and useful criteria than I think a lot of people use. There's sort of, you know, there's a lot of like, you know, winning by style points that happens in some kinds of software design where it's like, oh yeah, well this is, has this certain shape to it, or I don't even know. Can I write tests that run quickly is a criteria that is like,
right.
if you can't do that, it's not well designed.
And specifically as well, you mentioned quickly as well is like another thing you've kind of grafted on there, but we talked
yes.
about last time, but that's an important part of it.
No, that's a good point, is that it's like the kind of tests that I'm talking about where they are very focused, they can run very quickly, they're decoupled from things like the network, the file system, other services, you know, hardware even in certain situations.
Yeah.
Like if you can't write those kinds of tests, your code is not well designed, by my personal definition.
Yeah,
right?
No, I can see an argument for it. I think, you know, we might politely disagree about where the line is under some circumstances.
Yeah.
Because of pragmatism, which is...
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say, I think one of the places where that gets difficult is when you have constraints on your code that are related to hardware, related to performance, related to multi-threading is another dimension we talked about last time. And so, you know, one mm-hmm. thing that I would kind of love to get into with in this episode is talking about, like, in C++ specifically, some of the hurdles to doing things to increase testability that I would think of as good design, but you would, you know, maybe turn your nose up at and be like, yeah, okay, I get why you're doing that, but if you do that, then it's going to cost you this, right? And you really yeah. want to make that trade-off.
Right. I think that's it. I think that you've kind of cut to it there. Usually you only pick C++ if performance mm-hmm. is one of your primary goals. I don't think many of us rub our hands with glee and say, I'm going to write a mainly string processing application that's not performance critical in C++. That's not the first thing we'd go for. You know, you'd pick Python, you'd pick Perl, you'd pick Ruby, any of those things, JavaScript, they work beautifully. They have so they have a great user experience out of the box. C++ has a lot of hard work to even get it up to the point where you've got a build, let alone an executable that does something useful. So if you're picking performance, then one of the things that C++ leverages, if the compiler knows more about the way your software is put together and how your code fits together, it can do a much better job of optimizing it. So putting direct calls in your code to where the source code is visible to the compiler. So for example, if I have a class and I have methods in that class, and some of those class methods are actually even in the header file, and there are compiler technologies that make that less important, but like, you know, the implementation is there for everyone to see in your header file, then the compiler can often inline it, do a lot of great optimizations, and give you some super fast code, which is wonderful. But you have tightly bound and coupled the code that calls that function to the implementation of that, the specific implementation of that function. And that means that there is nowhere to put a little break in between to say, well, I'd like to observe the interaction between your component and the thing that you're calling. There is nowhere to put a test in there. Now, obviously, in other languages, and you can do this in C++ as well, you would use a mock often to say, well, I don't care about what you are doing. Moreover, I just care about the interactions you have with another object. So you mentioned file system. There's a great one. In C++, you probably would just use a std file system object. And that's great. It comes with the modern versions of C, and you get access to files and paths and all those good things, right? But it's a concrete object. There's no seam for me to mock it out unless I go out of my way to add one in. So even though file access is going to be slow, we know that it's not a highly performant area of the code. By default, we can't interrupt that communication and say, well, I'm not going to give you a real file here. I'm going to give you a pretend file.
Yeah, and I mean, that sort of dependency injection is what people generally refer to it as, is a common technique for testing.
Right.
But I kind of wonder, it's like, you know, you kind of just said, it's like, well, if we're going to be talking to a file system anyway, performance is kind of out the window, right? Like, at least in some respects. So mm-hmm. at least in that area, I would imagine, like, yeah, you might have to roll that abstraction yourself. you might want to roll that abstraction yourself, yep. depending on what you...
It might be right. a useful thing for you to do just because of
yeah.
your...
And yeah, I mean, right. you know, I actually think that this is one of the great benefits of testing in general, is that it forces you, when you are forced to decouple things, it makes you consider what parts of the dependency you actually need and which ones are just kind of coming along for the ride. And although it seems convenient
yeah.
oftentimes to have the full array of possible ways to interact with an object or a system or anything else, it is often quite nice to focus those interactions to be only what they have to be, because A, it reduces the number of possible code paths through your code, right? Like, if you're only using one
right.
thing,
yep.
then you just have to make sure that one thing works. You don't have to make sure that everything works. But it also sometimes makes it easier a little easier to understand, especially if you're coming into a new code base and you're like, okay, well, I know how this function call works, and they're using it all over the place, as opposed to, well, there's 12 of them, and I don't know what they do. So giving some thought to that, I think it has value.
So the kind of things you're talking about perhaps are, you know, obviously there's essentially the global space is mm-hmm. an object, if you want to think of it in that way, or a scope. It's a scope, you know, like calling just std file system :: file on mm-hmm. a thing gets you a file
yeah.
is in the global scope. But if I deliberately limit myself and say, well, no, this component I'm talking to only wants to load cache files, and it only really cares about the contents of those cache files, why don't I just hand it something for which that is the interface? And now I've kind of documented the interactions, and I've limited the interactions in a useful
yeah, exactly.
way. So the abstraction might actually have power above and beyond the testability that might be the initial reason I put it in place. I might put it there. And I do this all the time. You know, obviously we've worked together. We've done these, yeah. some of these things together before. But this is the kind of thing that I do. And I've had discussions with other C++ programmers who have come down on the side of like saying, I wouldn't necessarily add an abstraction purely for testability. And I've kind of gone back and forth on that, because I have done. I've added stuff, you know, like exactly in the file system is usually the arena where this stuff crops up, is like, yeah, okay, I'm going to add something which provides a file or provides a config loader or something like that. And then somewhere there's a thing that can do files, but most of the time it's my fake one for testing. But it was interesting finding that there were people who wouldn't do it just yeah. to add testability. But very often when I've done it, I have discovered that it's a useful thing. And perhaps that's what you're alluding to here is that, like, you've mentioned something about abstractions before, that they are what they're discovered.
Yeah.
Not...
Abstractions are discovered, not created, right? You need to sort of see how your system's
yeah.
used and then pull the abstractions out.
Right. And I've worked with a good friend of mine before now who has also referred to bad abstraction layers as obstruction layers, which I think we've all been there where you're like, well, I just need
yeah,
the thing on the
yeah.
other side of this wall. So there's always a danger if you're introducing these things where, you know, maybe you are decoupled from the file system in your config processing system. And you're like, well, I just want to see if the
yeah.
file exists. And now I'd love to reach out to the disk. And you now you're like, well, now I have to actually add this to the interface. But to your point, if I add it to the interface, then maybe I'm documenting more about the things that I actually need
yeah.
to do.
And I mean, I think you want to make those kinds of changes easy, but make them intentional, right? Like, if you're going to sort of break the abstraction a little bit and say, okay, well, I need to see if this file exists, design your code such that it's easy to add that, but then add it only when you need it. And I mean, I think one of the other great benefits that you get out of doing this is you sort of get a very low cost design for reuse. Like in their file example, if you have an abstraction that says, okay, I can read the contents of this file, I can stream it in, then if you have an abstraction there that's saying, well, it doesn't really matter if I'm reading from a file or from a socket, the code will work basically the same either way. But the second that I try to seek, then that abstraction now has been completely destroyed. And sometimes we make decisions
yeah.
about how to implement an algorithm. We're almost like looking for a reason to choose one thing over another, right? Like there's 8 different ways I could do this. Which one do I do? If you have the whole array of possible file system, you know, tools at your disposal, you might choose one arbitrarily. If you've focused it to be
right.
only a certain set of things, the choice is maybe, okay, well, I could arbitrarily pick one of these 8. Well, I'm going to choose this one because it's the one that I've already abstracted. And that naturally leads you toward designs that are more reusable, because it's like, oh, well, you could also do this with a socket and you'd never know the difference.
So we're going to go off track from C++ pretty quickly, but I would like to get back. There's some things I'd like to talk about. But one of the things I've seen in other programming languages, mock sort of setups, is their dynamism, so I'm thinking Python specifically here, their dynamism allows for the kind of thing where you can monkey patch out like the global file system routines and just say, hey, I want to test this thing. I know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, that it's going to open a file using this particular API. You essentially hack the runtime to say, no, if you call file.open, do this instead, and you temporarily install that patch, then you can write your test, and then you can say, yeah, okay, when I called the config system, and I know it loaded the file, and I was able to provide it the file, and I could assert that that was the case. But mm-hmm. That's so brittle. It's so brittle because I could reasonably refactor. I don't know if refactor is the right thing. Let's not talk about that. But I could easily change without too many external obvious changes the implementation of my config loader to use a different API. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds, as you say, there's a dozen ways you could have loaded a file. I could mmap the thing. I could, you know, open it. I could use path.open. I could use whatever. And now suddenly I've broken a perfectly reasonable test of that system because I just chose not to use the API. But if I force it through an interface that I designed ahead of time to say, well, these are the kinds of things you can do to the files mm-hmm. in this context, then necessarily I'm not mm-hmm. open to that. Now, obviously, I don't get the choice of doing that in C++, short of some absolute heroics with the preprocessor and hash defining a whole bunch of gunk to be things that they aren't, which is so dreadful. I'm not even going to go further down this logic setup. But actually, that does lead me to the other thing I wanted to talk about, which is when I do testing in C++, I typically do think of adding a virtual layer. So this is a class with virtual methods, which has a runtime mm-hmm. performance cost. And I've long argued back and forth various places about what the costs of that really are. And certainly back in the days of the games industry, the cost really was the indirect call instruction that it necessitated. Nowadays, that's less the problem. It's more like it's a barrier to the optimizer. The optimizer can't see across it, doesn't know what it's doing. But even that's coming down. But let's hold that to one side. But that means that you are definitely designing your software ahead of time with a very specific, strict contract. And that's the interface definition. There's another school of thought that lets you use template parameters into a function or a class to hand it essentially a policy object that says, this is the thing. When you want to use a file, use this object, this type of object. And that's a compile time change. The compiler can see which one you actually handed the implementation, and it can therefore generate, like, again, perfect fast code paths through. The virtual is a runtime decision that the compiler doesn't know that you've switched out on. So there is a way of having a lower overhead, runtime overhead version of essentially dependency injection. But it's a sort of insidious one because every type you pass around your program carries with it the parameters mm-hmm. that were given to that type. And so in your like real program, you might have, I'm using my config loader and its type is config loader, angle brackets, real file loader. So that's like the policy that it's going to use. But when you're using it in test, it's a config loader, angle brackets, fake file loader. But then that's all well and good until you want to embed that in another object. And now that other object carries with it the same dependency. Yeah, so transitively, you pick up all of these things. And it becomes harder to deal with. It's an interesting thing that I don't think many other languages have an analog to. And I don't know where I'm going with it, other than I tend to not use it because I hate the compile times that come along with it. And there are so many tricks you can do in the code that rely on the actual concrete types, because you can interrogate that. And it's a commonly done thing to say, like, well, what was my template parameter? Does it have a colon, colon, this? Does it have what is the type of its colon colon size type? Or I can dispatch on that. That now it's not the interface is not opaque to the implementation that's using it. You can actually inspect the implementation you are handed and make decisions, which means that you can actually have a different, I can use a trick to detect if it was really a fake one that I'd been instantiated with and do something different in my implementation. That could mean that you test one thing and your non-test case, it does something different.
Right.
And I don't like that. You know, I like the idea that almost essentially the library that I built that I link against the test.exe is the same library I then link against to create the thing that I'm going to ship off to production, as opposed to completely recompiling it with essentially a set of compile time processed parameters that could change the behavior. I just realized what I've just been doing is ranting for the last 2 minutes about this particular topic, as I feel so strongly about it. But it is it's a valid way of achieving this, and I've seen it used to great success. And in fairness, I have used it sparingly in contexts where I feel it doesn't leak outside of a small component, which I guess brings us right back to design. And maybe that's ultimately what makes me feel so uncomfortable about this, is that it's an abstraction that leaks throughout the entirety transitively through my design, and I don't really want it to. I want to hide stuff away. Without appealing to the kind of virtual method or interaction-based testing, typically what I find myself doing when I am writing testable C++ code is trying to chew off the smallest possible thing and test it as a component, and then test it in aggregation, and then test the aggregation, and then test the aggregation of that. So it's a very sort of build up. And I'm not testing the specific interactions between components, which because I can't see into them. But I know that my grommet works, and I know that my screw works, and I know that my nut and bolt work. And then I kind of sort of blindly trust a bit that putting them all together into a widget works, but I do test the widget. It's not like I'm there, but I know that I'm leaving something on the table there by not being able to test all of the interactions between the two. But I still think it's not an invalid way of testing in general.
No, I think that's a perfectly valid way of testing, and certainly dependency injection is not the only way to write testable code. Far from it. If you're working in a functional language, dependency injection is not even a thing.
Right.
Right. So, and I mean, I think the pattern that you're describing of building small components, whether they're classes or whether they're functions, and then assembling a system out of those, and then writing tests for the assembled pieces can work. And I have certainly done testing that way. The thing that you can run into when you do that is you sort of run into the problem of when you make changes, you wind up with a whole bunch of failing tests. So in an ideal world, and not even in an ideal world, that's a stupid phrase. People say that all the time. How about the real world? In the real world, when you do things in a certain way, what you get is when you introduce one bug into your system, you get one failing test. And I have built systems that have that property. It's not impossible. It's not even really that hard. But obviously working in different environments, different languages, different domains can make it a little harder. And if you are working in a language where, for other reasons, you wind up composing smaller components into larger components and then testing through the larger components, in addition to the tests that you might write for the smaller components, but if you're trying to test those interactions, the downside of that will be that you will probably wind up with, if you go to change a component, you might have dozens or hundreads of tests failing.
If I break my widget, then obviously everything that depends on it essentially is fair game for, or rather, if I might take my grommet that's in the widget, then all the widget tests are likely to fail as well, as are all the things that are further up the chain.
Right, right. And some of those things may be valid, right?
Yeah.
But not all of them will. And being able to this kind of gets back a little bit to what we were talking about with the file system, where if you have those abstractions, you can make a clear distinction between what's relevant and what's not, and sort of prevent the spread of irrelevant changes from going any farther than it needs to. It's tricky, and I think that when you're testing that way, you almost want to, I don't know, I kind of feel like you almost want to aim for a flatter structure. Like the ratio of leaves to nodes in your graph is, you want more leaves and, as opposed to the total number of nodes.
I suppose this, I just literally now this dawns on me, and that the thought is that in something like a C++ application, the higher up the sort of abstraction or even the composition tree you get, the sort of necessarily the fewer the interactions between those larger components that you've built are, to the point where you probably will get to a pragmatic point where you're like, well, this is my GPU. The interactions with the GPU are turn the screen on, draw triangles. Here's a giant list of triangles, clear the screen and flip the page buffer. Those are like the top level interactions that I'm going to do. And at that point, I'll gladly take the virtual overhead, whatever it is, because I've only got a dozen different interactions and they're infrequent in both in terms of the code and also the runtime. I don't have to do them very much. So the classic example, the reason I went GPU is one of the examples I pull out when I talk about this is how to decide when something should be a virtual like interface or not, specifically in C++. And the example I give is like an interface to a texture or a screen. So you can get like, how wide are you? How tall are you? You probably don't want to have a plot pixel and get pixel, because that's just not, that's too tiny a piece of work. It's a single machine instruction usually, or two machine instructions. So you're going to necessarily hamstring the compiler if you implement it as a virtual method. So you think, well, okay, what will I do? I'll allow access to maybe locking, getting a pointer to a contiguous region of that area, and then I'm on my own. I can monkey with it. I can read and write pixels directly, or I just get a pointer to the whole buffer and whatever. So that's a great sort of like point. The number of interactions you're likely to have is so high you would probably abstract it. But once you get to the flip the page, draw a triangle maybe. That's probably nowadays that you want to draw so many triangles, it's not a big deal. But once you get further up the hierarchy, that's the point where you say, okay, I'm going to put a seam in here and I'm going to divorce this part of the code from anywhere else. And anything else that wants to interact and test with this part of the code, I can always put a fake one of these in. Here's my fake GPU. Mm-hmm. Here's my fake screen. And then I can say, sure, you can paint all these pixels. Yeah, go for it. Do your thing. And then I can look at it afterwards. And there's no coupling there between the actual implementation and the thing. Whereas the GPU itself may be built out of components that are more tightly coupled and are tested more in that way that we said before, where it's sort of incrementally and transitively, you kind of like build up this idea that the GPU component is okay because transitively all of its components tested okay, and in aggregate they tested okay.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that hybrid approach is the right approach anyway, or the pragmatic approach under these circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you know, when I was working at that data visualization company in Houston that I mentioned, I did exactly that with 2D graphics. You know, we built a layer of abstraction on top of the graphics library. We were actually doing this in Java at the time, which was a little weird, but it would have worked. And we built a layer of abstraction on top of the 2D graphics system for testing purposes. But it also let us do a lot of other, like, very interesting things. It made it a lot easier when we needed to add functionality, like, oh, can you make a screen capture? It's like, well, yeah, I can just turn this graphics object that I have into a buffer, and now you've got your screen capture. Or
of course.
We actually even wound up doing a thing. This was also for testing purposes, although a very different kind of testing, where we would test some of our graphics code by rendering it into a buffer and then mm-hmm. running it through a vectorization program and seeing if we approximately got the same vectors out that we put in.
That's marvelous.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a little clever.
It's a miracle that worked.
It was a little clever, but it sort of told us some interesting things.
When you
about
say clever, are you meaning that in the slightly pejorative sense of the word clever?
Only slightly pejorative. It was a technique that was interesting that told us some things about our code.
Right.
I wouldn't recommend it as a general purpose technique for testing graphics. But it was possible. My point here is that it was possible because mm-hmm. of this abstraction that we had created. And so those kinds of things, I think to your point, it's like that is a perfectly valid technique. And I think thinking about where you want to add those sort of those virtualization calls in C++ or you know, the sort of layers of abstraction in whatever language you're working in, it's obviously not just testability is the only thing that you should be thinking about there. It's
sure.
It's also, you know, what are they going to be the other design impacts and the other, you know, performance impacts of doing this. But I really like your point about sort of the higher up you get, the fewer interactions there really seem to be. I think that's quite insightful.
From a C++ point of view as well, from a build point of view and whatever, the less coupling you have between components, the fewer coupling.
The less coupling?
The less coupling, yeah.
I think
coupling. It's the less coupling. But the less coupling you have between components, it's certainly possible to leverage that to make your builds faster, because you can carve the world up into parts that are dependent or not dependent on the interface changing, as opposed to some typo in a comment in the implementation of one of those functions or whatever you're at. And that sort of comes back round mm-hmm. to the conversation about fast changes to testing. So obviously mm-hmm. the big mm-hmm. Problem, the elephant in the room, with C++, well, it's not really an effort because we all know it's there and we can all see it, and it's like the build time. And your sort of worldview of testing is, and I've seen you do this, you know, you have a watch command running in one window and you've got VI in mm-hmm. another window, and you're literally saving. And as you say, your save is a micro commit to you, and the watch immediately notices that you save and it runs all the tests, and it's essentially a live dashboard of where you are in your process of developing. And that's super important. And in it, the rules of eights, which we talked about last time, if it's 800 milliseconds, that's instant, and you're like, I saved, yeah, that's cool, or whoops, no, I made a mistake, or no, that doesn't work. There's a cool feedback loop there. C++ out of the box tends not to have that. And in my experience, where at least part of my career I spent writing my own C++ parsers to try and make a whole new way of like even compiling C++ to try and solve this very problem, in my experience, you have to think about that from the get-go in C++. It's not something you graft on at the end. Like tests, right? You know, it's harder to do come in afterwards and write tests.
Right.
If you start from the ground up and say, okay, my build, in the limiting case of having just the whatever test library I've picked, you know, I like Catch 2, people like Google Test, there's a few of them, that linking with a simple test that just fails or just succeeds, or one of each, just to prove to yourself that you're actually capturing that. Can I even get that building and running in a somewhat interactive amount of time? And then you grow out from there and you take a deep breath every time you cross some threshold, an 8-second threshold. And again, we're never going to be 800 milliseconds in our world, I don't think.
Right.
But, you know, single digit seconds is fine. And then there are ways and means of both breaking up your code and making it compile faster, which we could perhaps talk about at length another time, but also making it so that your components are split away from each other so that you can run tests on just that component, be it a single file or a single clump of files that are together. And obviously your build process heavily interacts with this so that you can just say, look, I only changed this file. I know that loads of my code in theory is affected by this change, but I just want you to build the library and the tests for the library and ignore everything else, because right now I'm in that mode where I want to do that quick loop back, and all the other compile errors can wait until I've proven that I've gotten this right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like there's a whole category of things like that where whatever group of people you're working with, you all have to commit. You have to make a shared commitment to doing something a certain way. Otherwise, it's really not going to work out super well for you. One of them is testing.
Yep.
One of them, I think, is a commitment to these sort of fast build times and structuring the codes so that you can build things incrementally, you can build things quickly. Another one of those is deployment, like being able to deploy safely a running system. You 100%. Have to decide to do that at the start. It's very difficult to sort of, both from an organizational standpoint and from a technical standpoint, to sort of add that in later, right? Yeah,
continuous builds, continuous deployment, all these things kind of fit together well. They all go, they go together really well if you start them all together, but any one that I'm trying to put it in afterwards is a pain.
Yeah, it's much more difficult to do. It's not that it can't be done. It just takes hard work and it takes commitment from everybody involved. If you have half your team that's invested in fast builds and the other half is like, it's fine, I like coffee. You're just not going to get to where you want to go.
That is it. I mean, like, there's the whole sword fighting XKCD of, you know, what are you doing, right? Which,
right.
Yeah.
If you see that as an essential part of your job, it's going to be really hard to come along and have someone convince you that you should do a whole bunch of work to take your build time down from, you know, a minute to 8 seconds so that you can, you know, work in this fashion, right? Because A, you've probably never experienced before, so you don't really know what it's like and you don't really know why it's good. And B, it's like, it's kind of a huge risk. It's sort of like, well, how do you know this is really going to turn out like this?
That's a really good point. Certainly, I think there's a certain amount of institutionalization that I've seen with other companies I've worked at with the C++ developers where it is just taken as read that, oh, well, it's a 20-minute build every time you do anything significant. Nobody touch error.h, because if you touch error.h, everyone's cursed. Next time they get pull to have a 30-minute build, so off you go. And of course, you know, projects do get big, and so there are necessary things that take a while, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I remember having the same thing about, and we should perhaps even talk about this another time, like IDEs. I like IDEs perhaps more than VI, although I use both, and I know you're a VI user, and you know, you've seen IDEs and you appreciate them everything.
I like IDEs. I
it's just VI is an IDE.
I was a huge Eclipse fan. Well, no, that's Emacs. You're thinking of Emacs.
Oh, but the point I want to make is that I remember seeing somebody using IntelliJ, as it was at a very previous job, And they were just like a maestro playing a virtuoso playing an amazing instrument. The speed that the ideas were forming in their head to code appearing on the screen fully formed, followed by, well, maybe I shouldn't rename it that, you know, call the variable that. Oh, hang on a second, this is an interface, pull out an interface. It was wonderful to watch, and it totally changed the way that I thought about how you could program. And it moved me much further down the explorative tap on the keyboard, look around, maybe this, maybe not this, versus the, you know, sagely stroke your beard and think about it approach that we discussed a little bit last time. So there's a there's definitely something there. And I think that obviously as part of that suite of tools, having a fast build, having fast tests, all factor into that sort of local minima in the space of things that you can do to be productive, where you and I currently are, which is, you know, fast turnaround on builds, deploys, tests, all those things. Yeah, I mean, that's a good spot.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a really deep topic, right? Like we're not gonna cover this unfortunately in 45 minutes. And I think the aspects, you know, the style of we're working that we're talking about with fast builds and fast tests. The unfortunate truth is that you can't really see the full picture, I feel like, until most of those elements sort of come into play. And that makes this a complex topic to talk about. But I definitely think maybe on the next episode or any episode after that, getting more into the details of, you know, practically how do you do these things. It sounds like you've had, you know, through your attempts, you've had some experience with it. But there are also lots of other people that I know do this and have done it quite extensively.
Right.
So maybe we could mine the brain trust of the internet to figure
Absolutely.
This out. But I it's a very deep topic. I'm looking forward to talking about it more.
We'll do another one of these.
We should.
Cool.
All right.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Gottwald. Find the show transcript and notes at twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Twitter at @2CP. That's at @TWOSCP. Theme music by Inverse Space, inversebase.com.